So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to Rivulube!
It's baptism by fire, especially when the chairman is your father-in-law and his family. And he pulls no punches, he gives it to you straight. And if he feels you need a kick in the ass, well, Hunter gets a kick in the ass. So, you know, again, it's all done with the spirit of what's best for the business.
The little experiment called the Rated R Superstar was an abject failure. I hate to be the one to break it to you, but you never drew a dime, buddy.
This job is such a huge responsibility. He's hands-on. He knows everything about everything. It would drive me insane if I can't even walk and chew gum, let alone know everything that goes on.
Right before your world title match, and you're so calm, so cool, so collected. You know what that says? It says you've got no passion. You've got no desire. And you know what that says to me? That says to me that there is no way that you'll become world champion tonight.
He is developing the next crop of WWE superstars and divas. They're going to make it. I think the future is in incredible hands with Paul.
Woo! He hits the Spirit Squad all packed up!
This package is going to go to Louisville, Kentucky, is that right? And you fellas want this package insured?
Oh, no. No, this isn't worth the crap.
When I see him taking a newer talent under his wing, you have a pretty good sense that that guy has a much better chance than most at connecting with an audience.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm WWE superstar Mr. Kennedy. Everybody seems to want to hear from this guy. My guest at this time is former WWE champion, former world heavyweight champion, Triple H. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Mr. Kennedy. And let me be the first one to congratulate you on your return Monday night. Riveting television.
Hey, that's some of my best work ever.
And he's a very approachable and nice person for a lot of the talent to deal with.
Quite frankly, I'm done taking charity cases.
Whoa.
I am finished creating stars. I am finished letting people stand by my side, bask in my glory, while they try to make something of themselves. See, now, it's for me.
I wanna hide the truth, I wanna shelter you, but with the beast inside, there's nowhere we can hide. No matter what we breed, we still are made of greed. This is my kingdom come, this is my kingdom come.
Welcome everybody to Review Away. I'm waiting, and my guest, another very special guest host who's filling in for John Pollock. We have John Pollock.
Waiting, how are you?
Wow, you're back.
I am here.
You just appeared.
Yeah.
It's been like 2 weeks.
It's felt like quite a long time since
Actually,
it really doesn't feel like that long since I've talked to you because I've listened to so much of you.
Yeah.
Over the past couple of weeks.
You must have been quite sick of my voice.
No, actually quite the contrary way. I enjoyed seeing you interact with all these different people, hearing you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Yeah. I mean, I think we built out quite the family here around the law, and it was nice to at least talk to almost everybody.
A lot of branches coming out of this tree.
Yes. Where does that come from? Where did you come up with that?
Oh, old kendo analogy.
Right, yes. Okay.
Yes. I've gone through all the new rules. Yeah, Wei gave me this textbook about how we do things now around here.
Wow. So, I didn't know if you were coming
hope
back.
I hope I'm up to Wei's standards now that I'm back here.
Tell us about your trip, first of all. You were in Russia. You're married now, coincidentally.
What a surprise. Wow.
Just joking, he's actually not married. But tell us about the trip.
Well, Wei, I thought I could go into the trip, but okay. I thought we could do it over a Russian drink. Are you ready?
Oh, wow, a surprise.
I bought you some, so I thought you and I, for this, we could try some.
Whoa.
Red Devil. Elko Energy.
Oh, my God.
Red Devil, of course, the infamous team that Fyodor Emelianenko used to be a part of, or as I was told by the Russians, Fyodor Emelianenko.
That sounds right. This, I don't know if I can trust, man. This is like a...
This is alcoholic... An alcoholic energy drink.
This is a 7.2% alcoholic beverage. That's like 500 milliliters. I have to drive after this. And I just don't know... I don't know if I can trust something with like, Russian letters. Because to me, Russian letters looks like...
Okay, well, I do notice that you have a coffee. So that's yours. I got you that. And I got you a Russian doll.
Oh, wow.
While I was in Russia.
You got me a Russian doll with Chairman Mao's picture on front of it.
I looked at all these Russian dolls and I said, what screamed Wei
Tang? This is awesome, man. Like, he doesn't get much more communist than this.
Yeah.
A Russian Chairman Mao doll. Let me open it.
Yeah, there's quite a few of them.
Because
you, much like Chairman Mao, you were chairman of the law while he was gone.
So underneath, this is awesome, man. Underneath Chairman Mao, these are other Chinese, I assume, Communist Party figures.
I assume so. Yep.
Zhao Enlai, Lu Sun. Well, you should pronounce these names for me because you have quite the.
Did you catch any of the wushu action?
I did not, unfortunately.
Because I made sure to give it a waiting. Welcome everyone to Men's Tao Lu. And I said it as silly as that sounded.
That's how I pronounce all Chinese, despite it not being...
Before I left for Russia, Wei and I, we went for a beer somewhere, and Wei is telling me over and over, he just kept saying, Tao Lu, Tao Lu. So that was stuck in my head the whole trip there. I'm like, I'm not going to screw this up.
Yeah, that's how I just, by default, pronounce Chinese.
It's probably not even the right way, is it?
No, it's probably
completely
wrong.
Screwed with me.
This is awesome, man. This is really cool.
It's nothing earth-shattering. I just wanted to get you something, Wei, as a token of my appreciation.
Thank you so much, man. Thank you so much. This is, well, honestly, it was nothing. It was actually quite a lot of fun, but I think this is cool. I'm gonna Instagram this.
How do you... I'm going to sound like
you didn't
50.
You didn't Instagram at all.
I tried. Do you know how hard it is to post a picture on Instagram on your phone?
It's not hard at all.
This would be terrible radio, but I'll show you later. Like, I couldn't figure out how to post a goddamn picture on Instagram. I took like 2,000 photos.
Yeah, what are you talking about? You open the app, you hit the little icon with the camera on it, you select your picture, and that's
And then
it.
My thing would crash every single time.
Well, there's something wrong with your phone.
Man, unreal.
Yeah.
So, no Instagram during this trip, but I did post some pictures on Twitter. I want everyone to go to my Twitter account. I don't want to force people to go find something new.
Yeah, maybe Snapchat. You get on that?
No, I don't think I'm going to make it to Snapchat.
No?
Just finished listening to you and Tom Lawler. What a chat you two had.
Yeah, well, he
covered everything. Dick pics, dick sizes. There was a theme going
on. That's pretty much everything.
Yeah. Lots of penises.
You know, it just organically comes up in conversation.
In a funny follow-up to one of your stories was myself and John Ramdeen did go to M1 on... one of the nights.
Yes.
Coincidentally, the same night as Bound for Glory. I was watching live combat, but it was the M1 Challenge variety. First of all, to confirm Tom's story, M1, very, like, 8,000-9,000 people were at this event, and that was considered like a down crowd for them because it was running on a Sunday night. Traditionally, they run like a Friday-Saturday deal.
Okay.
So anyway, they ran Sunday night, and I had my data turned off throughout this whole trip, so I only kind of relied on Wi-Fi, so I got back to the hotel, hooked up the Wi-Fi and got an email inviting us to the M1 after party.
No way.
Afterwards. So,
whoa.
Man.
And you went?
No. We had gotten home at this point. The Ice Palace was like halfway across the city of St. Petersburg.
Could have seen a bunch of naked chicks.
I know. All the cocaine and hookers
we
missed out on, unfortunately.
So I guess after every M1 event, they must have one of these.
I guess so. Yeah.
Wow.
Jeff Monson was fighting on this card against Satoshi Ishii.
Uh-huh.
Jeff Monson. Oof.
Yeah. What happened?
He's just so slow. I mean, this guy fought for the UFC heavyweight title, amazingly, back at UFC 65, an event I believe you were at in Sacramento, where George St. Pierre won the title from Matt Hughes the first time.
No, I was not.
You weren't at that event. But anyway, so 2006, that guy fought for the UFC heavyweight title, and he's just become like this this American heavyweight who just always gets fights in that part of the world. He already has another fight scheduled for a couple weeks from now.
He just looks like such an intimidating guy, you know, on paper.
Until you see him walk down to the ring where he is just walking at a snail's pace.
Right.
The best part about M1, though, was the entrances, where they had, like, these break dancers come out, and it's like they're all dancing all over the place. You got Lenny Hart doing the introductions, and it's like fucking Lose Yourself is playing as one of the Russians comes out, like, right at the chorus. Their entrances blow away UFC's entrances.
Cool. Nice. So
that was the best part of M1.
What else? What were some other trip highlights? Tell us about the food.
The food was really hit and miss. The hits were the infamous pork knuckle that I have tweeted about, which is, I want to say top three meal I've ever had, but the other two aren't coming to mind. This was so great. A pork knuckle is like the foot of one of these, a hoof. And what they do is, it's this giant thing of meat on this heavy bone. They braise it all day. Then they put this skin around it that they deep fry. But then they also bake the whole thing. Like, it's a multiple-hour process. So then they serve it on sauerkraut with gravy and, like, fries or chips on top of it. It's just, everything's incredible about it. Like, every bite is, my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever put inside of my mouth.
Okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it was just a phenomenal meal. That was the high point. The low point was... some of the food that we were given on a daily basis was just horrendous. One person on this trip, we were discussing if this is worse than prison. And this guy at our table said, I've been to prison. This is worse. Yikes. Where we would wake up every day, you'd have to go find someone for a meal ticket, and then it was the same food every single day, the same breakfast. It was like these eggs that were like drowning in water. It was like stale bread.
Like bad hotel, like cheap hotel breakfast.
I don't even want to be slanderous to hotel breakfast, because there's guaranteed you've never had anything at this level.
Wow.
The nickname for lunch and dinner was simply going for gruel. That's what this was. It was the same shit every lunch, every dinner.
And the athletes were eating this too, weren't they?
Yeah, this was the complimentary food. So
you could
pay for your own food and venture out, which is what we quickly did. Myself and Corey Erdman, we found a Pizza Hut nearby, which was like a godsend. We only went there once.
Is there anything different about Pizza Huts in Russia?
Nothing.
How about McDonald's in Russia?
McDonald's, we went on the last day, and all I got was a muffin and a coffee. They have, I want to say they have a few different things, but I didn't eat any of the food, so nothing's coming to mind. I mean, it's McDonald's. You're not exactly
venturing. McDonald's are actually different, like, in a lot of different places.
They definitely, like, had their own kind of specialties to it.
Yeah.
That was a nice kind of bookend, because my first day, I woke up super early and just wandered the city by myself and ended up in McDonald's, where I was just so intimidated to order. This woman comes up to me in the lineup and is just like, yells out something Russian to me. And I was just like, I'm sorry, do you speak English? And she just like gave me the most disapproving look and walked right by me as she like knocked into my shoulder as she walked by. And I just felt so lost and out of place that I just left and then realized that all I had to say was coffee. She would have known exactly what I wanted. But then I went there the last day and I got my coffee. So I felt like in the end I conquered Russia, or at least the McDonald's.
Well, how did you order coffee?
I went with John Ramdean and he assisted here. He just ordered everything for people. I was like, I want a coffee. And I looked at the guy, I was like, coffee? Milk. And he's like, yep.
So how much Russian did you actually pick up?
I know that to say thank you, it is spasiba, I believe.
Okay.
I tried speaking Russian to this one woman when I ordered food at this one place, and I'm struggling here. And I say spasiba, and she just laughs out loud at me. Like, I speak English, you don't have to try. So that was the food portion of the trip.
And that was it? Like, any other Russian terms? Like, you were able to get by just with that?
It really was, like, because we were in the hotel that was essentially rented out to so many of the athletes, so many of the organizers, that, I mean, Russian was, like, just a small portion of what you interacted with. It's like there were people, it's like, man, that corner, it's like there's all the Venezuelans. Over there, there's the Cubans who were trying to sell Cohibas to other athletes. There was one night we came home, and the Japanese karate team, consisting of some smaller Japanese people were just standing outside the hotel, like just completely like laughing, and all of them just vomiting everywhere. There's one guy, he's just like looking like he's like dazed, and another guy's leaning over into the garden vomiting. The other guy's right in front of the hotel, just fucking projectiling everywhere.
Wow.
So they probably just had the lunch, I'm guessing, or they had been drinking a bit.
Yeah.
But the actual broadcasting part, we got there like 5 or 6 days before we even had to start calling stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Is this too much?
No.
Okay, I get the sense you're ready to move on.
Well, I mean, I've actually...
Keep me in line, Wei.
No, because, I did meet up with John before this, and we did talk a little about this.
Wei's heard everything about this.
No, not everything. I am curious. I was about to lead into the broadcast itself. You did a ton of preparation. You seem quite stressed.
I was absolutely stressed out of my mind when I was first told about this trip, I would say, mid-August, and there was no less... then I would say 5% of me that thought this trip would actually happen. I was just like, there's no way this is going to happen. This sounds like it's something that was said in passing, like, oh, you should bring some of your guys over to call the stuff. So it didn't really, most of August, I didn't really take it too seriously until the end of August when it was like, no, this is happening. And we actually got the sports that we were going to have to call. And I mean, I was given Muay Thai, I was given freestyle wrestling, grappling, wushu. And it's, you know, first of all, unlike John Ramsey and Robin Black and Corey Erdman, I mean, they do lots of commentary. I mean, they are very, very fluid at it. For me, I'm a fish out of water at doing commentary, much less for some of these sports. I was going to be doing play-by-play by myself. Mm-hmm. So I was just completely scared out of my mind for some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I was given 3 weeks notice that I'd be doing judo, which was just so complex that my whole life for all of September and then into October was preparing for these combat games.
Yeah.
I mean, I was going to work and I was watching as much of this stuff as I could, reading as much as I could about this stuff. I have never prepared for something more than I did for these combat games. So
it's like you were competing.
Sort of. So when I finally got there, like, I felt ready to call all of this stuff, but still it was the X factor, too, of, like, I don't do commentary. It's like, I don't know how I'm going to flow, and it was just kind of, you just had to throw myself into the fire, essentially. But mm-hmm. I was probably a miserable person to be around for, you know, the 3-4 weeks leading into this.
You're okay.
I'm a miserable person most of the time, nothing too out of the realm. But, I mean, coming out of it,
How do you feel? How was the whole thing?
Overall, very good. Yeah. I mean, by no means do I feel I'm, you know, Pat Summerall or anything, but I felt that I feel very comfortable now doing commentary.
At least Michael Cole? Do you feel like you're Michael Cole?
Hey, man, a lot of people give Michael Cole a lot of grief. Michael Cole is very good at what he does, of what the WWE... That guy is juggling, like, 8 balls for 3 hours on Raw every Monday night.
Yes.
I mean, he's, like, directing traffic on there with 2 other guys. I'm not going to say he's my favorite broadcaster, but that guy does a very good job at what he's needed to do.
Okay, what about... how about a Mike Adamly? Do you feel like a Mike Adamly, at least?
Did Mike Adamly do play-by-play in WWE?
Didn't he do some?
He did it. Yes, he did. He did at one point.
Yeah.
Him and Taz.
Would you put yourself above him?
I don't know.
Come on. Put yourself over somebody.
There's probably people out there who will say no. Mike Adamly
will agree.
Blow smokes around you. I don't think I called anyone Jeff Harvey, so that was a positive.
No,
I really stressed on learning these names.
Yeah, tell me about some of these names. I loved your little pun there that the other guy did almost reacted to.
Oh, right.
Gone.
I felt very comfortable with my judo color commentator Mike Swain, who is just the greatest guy possible. Like, for my first 2 broadcasts, I was paired with this guy. He's a 4-time Olympian. We just hit it off right away. I went there about an hour before the broadcast, and him and I just chatted about so much stuff. Learned that he was, you know, mentored by Alan Cowage, Bad News Alan.
Wow.
So that was pretty cool. And by the second day, I was like, when I was doing this commentary, it was just like, I had so many puns coming to mind. I mean, there were just so many that I just wanted to throw out. And then there was this one guy whose last name was Gone. And he was like he was
G-A-N
from like Georgia. So he had like an 18 letter first name, one of many. And I just said, you know, time winding down here. If he can't get that final Wazari, he's going to be gone. I said something like that, and sure as shit, Wei heard this.
I heard this, yes. And Mike,
I was so happy.
And your partner was like...
There was like a 5-second delay, and then he laughed.
Oh, tell us about your kendo partner.
Kendo, he was very different. It was this guy by the name of Dieter Hulk, who is the vice president of the European Kendo Federation. And he came in the first day, and he had never done any broadcast work before, but has dedicated his life to kendo. And, you know, we didn't meet him the first day he came in, but we kind of heard secondhand that, you know, he's a really gruff individual, very much like, you know, myself and Corey Erdman were going to be doing play-by-play with him, Corey on the first day, me on the second. So he was very much just like, what do these two know about kendo? Have they dedicated 30 years to kendo? Because I have. So, like, that's what you hear, and it's like, oh, really? Is this going to be just a confrontation? Like, I just want to put on a good product here. I just want it to sound good. I don't want to be, you know, I am not an expert in kendo here, but I feel I'm more than competent in explaining what kendo is, who these athletes are, telling the stories, essentially, and you be the guy who explains why this is happening and explain it to us, including me, because I do not have an ego when it comes to, hey, what is happening here? So the first day went by fine with Corey, and then I came in on the second day, sat down with him. I got there like, you know, 45 minutes early just to sit with him and chat. And he immediately just went into like a kendo lesson with me off the air. And he was just like going over all this stuff. I'm like, oh, this is great. I'm going to ask you this stuff on the air, blah, blah, blah. And it turned out fine. But he was just like he had a voice. Like he was just like so like cerebral in his delivery. And he's explaining, you know, all the intricacies of kendo. But I did, as a result of hearing these stories about him and just, I went home that night and I did so much more research on every one of these athletes. I mean, looking up the most obscure of kendo tournaments to bring out stats that I don't know what they mean. But wow.
You wanted to impress this guy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. It was like, oh, listen, I'm not going to wow this guy with my kendo knowledge, but believe me, I'm a research machine, and I can pull out some stats and stuff. So I'm running down, you know, this guy placed here in the All Japan Kendo tournament last year and throwing out all these facts. So it turned out it went fine. And afterwards, you know, I think he was just very nervous about doing broadcasting for the first time and wanting to, you know, he's doing this with a stranger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's a very high-ranking kendo official. So,
yeah.
You know, it's a different world for people who have never, you know, the idea of being on the air is quite intimidating for some people. For me, it was just, you know, calling this stuff and sounding knowledgeable in it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, by all accounts, it seems like you know, all your preparation paid off.
Well, obviously. It was certainly a trip that I definitely learned a lot from, but also that it absolutely frightened me beforehand.
Yeah.
But sometimes you need that to kind of push yourself to develop new skills. You have to have that fear of failure.
Oh, wow. Sam, yes. You sound just like a fighter, man. You sound just like you're training for a fight.
Well, I certainly don't look like a fighter.
But tell us, you had a run-in with like a listener or a fan, somebody who watched you?
I met a few. I met the elusive Josh Kachenko.
Wow.
Met up with him quite a few times, actually, over in Russia.
That's cool.
You know, it gave us kind of the 411. I don't know what the Russian equivalent of 411 is.
Told you how to stay away from the traffic and not get hit by cars?
Yeah, which wasn't success. I saw a number of car accidents. Our own Corey Erdman got smoked by a car one day while he was jogging. The cars are just out of control. Like, you cannot be texting and walking in this city because they don't give a fuck, dude. They will just run you over if you're in their way.
The drivers are probably texting.
They could be. Yeah. I don't know if they are. I think they're just, listen, my foot the weight is on the gas right now. If you make me alleviate weight, that's just not going to happen.
Yeah. I am not going to release my foot to step on the brake.
No, absolutely not. So that was certainly an eye-opener. Just looking at, you know, there were crosswalks where people, like, were sprinting to get to the sidewalk in time. Because clearly there was fear of not hitting that brake.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, I didn't get hit by a car, thankfully. But there were a few times where, you know, we were getting driven around and our drivers were just fearless. And I was like, oh, my God. Like, I had to just close my eyes at certain times.
Oh, my God.
So
you're alive.
I'm alive. Yeah. I made it back. A horrendous flight back on Sunday night where they lost my luggage. They lost all of our luggage, all our whole Fight Network crew. We had a quick connection in Germany, and the luggage didn't make its way onto the flight back to Toronto, so we were without our luggage for 24 hours, and I was nearly dead by the end of this last flight. Like, I had a migraine, and I was just ready to vomit by the end of that flight. It was just a horrendous flight.
And what was the first thing you did?
I vomited when I got off the airport. Off at the airport, I made my way to a washroom, which had one stall, which was being in use. So then I ran. I had to go through customs, and then I finally made it to a washroom where I just, vomited.
Cute.
Welcome back to Toronto.
And the second thing you did was probably watch.
To really emphasize my wrestling that I follow. Every time I throw up, it's Vince McMahon's his voice.
He's gonna
puke.
Yeah, yeah.
So there you go. That was my trip. I'm not big on. I'm sure stories will come here and there, but I won't bore you to death with stuff.
Yeah.
Overall, though, very very enjoyable trip. But I certainly miss doing all these shows with you. I will absolutely say.
Well, likewise, man. I will say, I've already said in a lot of these podcasts, but I don't think any of us realize exactly how much work you do on a daily basis. And, at least I think it took like five of us to pretty much fill in for what you do on a daily basis. And I'm extremely thankful that I don't have to go through that until some other time when you're away.
Yes. Well, thank you again, Wei, for stepping in.
No problem.
I was amazed at all the stuff you did while I was gone. Shows were way better than the ones with me on them. So
I
hope I can just live up to the waiting standard. I mean, you've set the bar pretty high.
I will not agree with that at all. No, but it was just fun, and we had a lot of support from obviously our whole family of guests, and everybody. Just I think we're trying to do our best to keep the train running.
Yes, so a big thank you to everyone, including all the people who stepped in with Wei, for Blaine doing the law updates.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a big effort by people just chipping in and giving up their free time.
Yeah.
Well, Wei, we are going to dive back into our reviews because we've got the Triple H, the love story, Triple H.
Yeah, are you happy that we were doing this week? Because this was originally supposed to be your last review before going to Russia.
Yeah, it was.
Before our big debacle.
You know, it was actually... it worked out very well because we had, our one week where we missed out because of that Jim Crockett debacle where we had to do the review twice.
The only lost show we've ever had.
The greatest review we ever did, and it's gone forever.
Yep.
This actually worked out well because I thought, I'm going to have 2 weeks. I'm sure I'll have some downtime. I can watch this documentary while I'm in Russia. I had no time to watch this at all. I did try to keep up with what I could while I was over there. I watched Raw both weeks. I did catch Bound for Glory, and I did catch a few matches from the last New Japan pay-per-view, but that's about all I saw while I was gone, so I wasn't following everything too heavily. Did I miss anything big? Not really.
I don't think so.
I think the last thing I saw before I left was like Battleground or something.
Yeah, I don't think you missed anything.
But this worked out great. I got home. I watched some of this, actually, before I even left, and for whatever reason, I wrote down my notes on the first hour. So, of course, my notes were in my luggage that was in Germany. I was like, if I don't get my luggage back in time for this review, I'm going to be pissed. But then last night, my luggage arrived. So I do have my notes, and then I did the rest here getting through this. What an interesting documentary, Wei. This was, I said this to you earlier. If someone did this for me, I would feel so uncomfortable.
I'm sure. I mean, what, just the documentary in general?
I could not stand people talking about me like this for this amount of time.
Yeah.
That's to me, listen, I understand this is a promotional tool, but I feel there deserves to be some kind of, I don't know, someone playing the devil's advocate, some obstacles this guy created for himself. Like, it seemed the only person who had anything critical to say about Triple H was Triple H,
yeah.
Who would bring up, you know, this WrestleMania match, it didn't work so well. We had a lot of stuff going against us. It was a bad storyline. It's like Triple H was comfortable to say this, but other guys weren't.
Yeah.
And as well, I think it just comes across that, you know, this guy is presented, you know, this is the guy who's going to succeed Vince McMahon, and here are all these people around him that are all just going to sing his praises,
yeah.
A few of whom, who before they were back with the company, were saying a 180 about this guy.
Of course.
So we'll get into all of that. But overall, that's what I took away from this documentary. It was just uncomfortable. Maybe it was the length as well of this, but my God, it was... Thy Kingdom Come was a perfect title for this because Triple H was our father.
Well, yeah, this documentary was, what, 2.5 hours, which is the standard length of a lot of their documentaries. But think about it, man. Like, this guy, if you were asked to make a documentary about your boss, how else would you treat this? You know what I mean?
I would think that, you know, there are environments out there where you can say good and bad about someone and not come across as disrespectful or, you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure you, if I asked you to talk about me, I'm sure you could bring up a lot of flaws that I have. And you know what? If I was a dickhead, I'd be like, fuck you. But if I was a normal, rational person, be like, you know what? I trust Wei's opinion and he is around me a lot. And I would assume that, yes, that is something I need to work on.
Yeah, I would do that with you. But I mean, if you were Triple H and if you were my superior and, you know, working in an environment like the WWE or pro wrestling where not shaking hands could get you fired or, you know, some other bullshit.
What if I said about you, you're the Michael Jordan of sports entertainment? Or I upped it by saying, sports entertainment, he's it. He's it. What a great guy.
I'd be very flattered at the same time.
No, you wouldn't.
I would be very flattered.
Very uncomfortable when I get compliments. Like, very uncomfortable. Yeah. I try to change the stuff. I just feel weird about that stuff. I don't like, I don't know. Yeah, we're getting psychological.
Well, that's why you're not Triple H.
I guess not. I just feel that when I get a compliment, actually, my reaction is to point out something that didn't work, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's good to an extent, but you should be able to rest and say at some point and be like, yeah, I am pretty good. I am really
well, great. This is going to be a review in human psychology, I think, what we're going to get into. When did you watch this?
I watched this on Sunday, actually. Actually, during the pay-per-view, as it was happening, I watched this instead.
How were you watching both at the same time?
I watched the pay-per-view afterwards.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, Triple H, Thy Kingdom Come.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the first documentary they've put out on Triple H. They put out many a DVD on this man.
Yeah, but I mean, what about that China and Triple H thing that they did on VHS back then?
Yeah, which we did review. That was like half work, half shoot. It was very much, I wouldn't compare it to this. This was like the full-blown Triple H life. Gospel.
Yeah, the life story.
Yeah, which is interesting when you look at this guy. A lot of... Like, he's been kind of presented as, like, Jesus. Like, the King of Kings, Thy Kingdom Come.
Yeah.
I imagine one day they'll do an angle where he's on a cross, dying for the sins of others.
Right.
Maybe.
Right.
Stations of the Cross match. Why haven't we seen one of those?
What is that?
Stations of the Cross?
I'm not a Christian. I don't know.
You know what? We'll hang out next Easter, and I'll teach you all about the Stations of the Cross. Jesus had to go. It was really like a... You know, 7 levels of hell that Jesus had to go through to...
Totally do a match like that.
We're going to offend somebody with this. The documentary, it starts off, no expense spared in terms of talking heads in this. Like, sometimes, you know, these DVDs are kind of washed down by, I don't really care what the Brooklyn Brawler has to say about CM Punk or Harvey Whippleman. I mean, they had all the big guns out here, including names from the past. They brought in Dave Bautista. We even heard from Brock Lesnar here. Very rare out of
out of character, in character interview for Brock Lesnar. I mean, I don't think he's ever appeared in one of these DVDs, at least during this run.
The Undertaker talking.
The Undertaker was the biggest one. Yep. I thought he was the best part of this DVD because
he was somebody who was not afraid.
Absolutely, yeah. Him. You know, the Undertaker, Vince McMahon, even Batista. I would say there are certain guys. Shawn Michaels, who it's like, they don't need to say anything. They are kind of untouchable. That I took, they had a certain higher level degree of credibility than others.
Yes and no. I mean, I don't know about...
Like, The Undertaker, to me, I took what he said as, you know...
Yeah. At the same time, you hear somebody like Batista call Triple H the Michael Jordan of pro wrestling.
He might actually believe that.
Yeah,
this guy's learned everything he has learned was from Triple H and Ric Flair. I don't think he really has a reference point outside of
fine.
Those two.
That's fine, but that's a personal opinion.
That's all I'm asking for. I'm not asking for, you know, just be honest. Whereas Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, to me, these guys left the company years ago. And they went on every outlet and just bashed this guy. Mm-hmm. And listen, I understand you want to get a job with the WWE. You've got to somewhat water down your opinions. But to hear these two on this DVD just praise this man to no limit, that's fine. You can do that. But in exchange, you've given away all your credibility. And I found those two guys had zero in this documentary.
Oh, absolutely.
There may never be as good... guys as good athletically and mentally about this game than Triple H.
This job is such a huge responsibility. He's hands-on. He knows everything about everything. It would drive me insane if I can't even walk and chew gum, let alone know everything that goes on. And he does a good job of it.
But Hunter was always a dick. Can I say that?
Yeah.
And what's up with that freaky mustache?
He's a fucking idiot.
I second that. I almost broke his nose one time.
You know, it's kind of, for me personally, was to get along with them because, Hunter, mostly. Because, whipping his ass would get me fired. That would have got me fired. You beat him up, you get fired. You know, and I wasn't about to sacrifice, you know, the career that I had and taking care of my kids and my family at the time for whipping his ass. So, you know, I kind of just, you know, whatever. You know, just let it blow off. Just let it blow. But I promise you, I promise if he were to come up to me and say something, I'd beat his fucking brains in.
Yeah.
Because he's a no good motherfucker, you know. If you and I'll say this just to kind of level down, he's got talent. He is. I don't take none of that away. He does have talent and he can work. But when you can do that, when you can bring other guys with you and bring other guys to that point to make the whole company better? Why would you not do that?
I wonder what exactly, you know, how they patched that up with Triple H, because I'm sure those comments were heard from those shoot DVDs.
Well, it's pro wrestling as well, and I think that Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, did they really feel as much hatred towards Hunter, or was it simply they were trying to get some attention for themselves when they were out of the spotlight? I'm sure there's a lot to that. I'm sure there were some real feelings that were harvested when they were gone, but... You know, they might have amplified them outside, as they've clearly amplified their positive feelings while back in the WWE family. But
yes.
Funny how the signature on your paycheck can really affect the words that come out of your mouth.
Yeah.
Anyway, interesting to see if they correspond with the thoughts in one's head. Continue this interesting lesson in history. The early days of Triple H. What I kind of liked about this way is much like when I read a biography on someone, I really don't care about the childhood stuff and where you went to school and what you did in your summer time off.
Yeah.
I don't care about that stuff. Just get into the meat and potatoes of why I bought this DVD. And they pretty much do that here, where they explain how he got into wrestling, meeting Ted Arcidi, going to train with Killer Kowalski, and they had some rare training footage of here. It just seemed they went like the extra mile here for this DVD. It was just the... nothing was an obstacle for them here of just tracking down footage, tracking down people to interview, and they kind of just got right into things about him debuting under Kowalski and then quickly rising up and joining WCW pretty early in his career.
There's a funny story about how he gained the name Terror Ryzen, and that was because of Kowalski, who just wanted to name him the Terrorizer, and then Triple H said, oh, why couldn't I have a, you know, a real name with a first and last name? And then Kowalski basically just decided to split Terror Ryzer in half, and it became Terror Ryzen.
One of the ultimate great names out there in Terror pro wrestling Ryzen. History.
Very funny. He also talked in his promos with a heavy Boston accent. I don't know what this was.
Well, he was from New Hampshire, so I'm sure.
So was this an actual accent he had and got rid of eventually, you think?
Yeah, maybe he just...
Because his dad spoke with him.
Oh, yeah.
And dad spoke with him.
Yeah, his parents were interviewed on this, and they seemed like really sweet parents.
Yeah.
Who
like
had...
The complete opposite of, like, the rich, you know, like, Vincent...
I couldn't even picture these two parents, like, sitting down for dinner with the McMahon family, you know what I mean? Like, they seemed like... A sweet couple that doesn't know anything about pro wrestling.
Yep, a sweet couple who, you know, seem to get by on, I don't know, probably very, I don't know, average means. They just look like completely normal parents. I thought it was, you definitely notice where he gets his nose from, because even as a kid, Triple H had a big nose, and so does his dad, so that's where I think the lineage comes from.
Yeah, Triple H says early, right from his debut, he says, I always looked at the business as a business, which is a telling line. I think a lot of guys could take that advice as a positive, you know, looking at it that way. They talked about him getting into WCW. They offered him a 2-year deal. Instead, he took a 1-year deal at $52,000 a year.
He talked about, you know, making $52,000 a year like he was going to starve. He basically said that was too little money, like $52,000 was not enough, and so he turned down that amount, hoping for more the second year. And,
well,
wow.
in fairness to this specific industry, you also have to remember that for a lot of these guys, all their expenses on the road came out of their own pocket. So $52,000 was your gross each year, but what your net, you know, salary was probably significant less here, where at least for the WWE, they would, you know, kind of they would buy you your ticket, drop you off in wherever, New York, and then you'd have to get your rental car, get to city to city to city, and then you get a ticket at the end of the whole tour. But in between that, your hotels, your cars. So I mean, $52,000, it's, you know, not a slave wage, but at the same time, you know, your expenses are also pretty high in this industry.
Right, right, right.
We heard from BG James here. They actually have an extra on the DVD of those two having a singles match in WCW, where BG pretty much looks like a replica of Kenny Powers at this point in his career with the curly mullet. And after the 1 year, Hunter got the offer from the WWF and was able to jump, leaving WCW, and came in as Hunter Hearst Helmsley. And WCW, what we took from it was that that was where he first met up with Terry Taylor and William Regal, kind of took him under his wing at the time. And Hunter's always had that loyalty, especially to Regal. And now Terry Taylor's back in the fold in the WWE. Mm-hmm. So, you know, kind of cultivating those relationships back in WCW. And I was glad they had Regal on this DVD because, I mean, this guy has literally seen this guy from start to finish of at least his national run.
And Regal, too, seemed like somebody who was not afraid to really speak his mind about Triple H, saying how, you know, when he first met the guy, he had terrible footwork and whatnot. And you could tell that, you know, clearly, like, there's a mutual respect there between each other and, you know, Regal, despite... Not even being you know, anywhere near the level of superstar that Triple H was, still commanded a level of respect from the guy.
Yeah, and Regal, I mean, you look at it now, he's been with the WWE now for 13 years.
Mm-hmm.
An incredible run for anyone at this point.
Considering how much he's fucked up?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, he certainly has issues over those 13 years, but always someone that... I think people appreciate as a talent, but it seemed that Vince McMahon was never a big fan of, like, Regal's style, and it was always Hunter that kind of backed this guy throughout this whole time. Taker is then introduced when he comes into the WWF, describing Hunter Hearst Helmsley having what he just calls a horrible gimmick at that time. When were you watching a lot during this 95 period? Because this is when they were bringing in so many guys and really a lot of gimmicks coming up. I remember 95 you were getting, you know, your TL Hoppers. And Hunter Hearst Helmsley was one of just a bunch of guys that they debuted at this time. I remember... It was like an issue of WWF Magazine where they just had this whole story on all these new guys that they were bringing in. It was like 12 guys, and he was just one of 12 faces.
Yeah, you know, if you weren't watching back then, he was basically doing the Damien Sandow character from back then. You know, the kind of aristocratic rich guy who thinks he's better than everybody else, would come out with a hot girl. And that can only get you so far.
Yeah, we heard as well from they had Kevin Nash and Sean Waltman interviewed for this, where Triple H quickly formed an association with the Clique in the back and started riding with them, where Kevin Nash says, you know, this guy was our designated driver because he didn't drink, he didn't really do a lot of drugs or anything, didn't do any drugs for that matter, don't want to get sued. And so he just clicked with them. I didn't even mean to say that. It's been a while. I gotta get them all out.
Yeah.
So... it was interesting to hear from them, and Hunter's just kind of, you know, just middle of the card. He's not lighting the world on fire at this point. Early in 96 was when they brought in the Ultimate Warrior for WrestleMania. It was his big return.
Oh, they didn't talk about that.
They didn't bring that up at all, because Hunter, that was certainly a very pivotal point of his career, where Hunter... kind of in his head worked out this big match to have with Warrior. He knew he was putting Warrior over, presented this idea to Warrior, and Warrior just kind of laughed at him and said, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to come in and I'm going to beat you in a minute. And that's how this is going down.
Yeah.
And I think Hunter always held a certain resentment towards Warrior for this, which is interesting now that Warrior's semi in the mix at this point with the video game deal. But that wasn't brought up at all in the DVD.
No, nor was any footage shown. They did, however, basically treat the curtain call at Madison Square Garden as a turning point in his career. I mean, it very much had the same effect. How, to my knowledge, really the first time they kind of really showed and talked about the curtain call in depth.
Yeah, at least in a WWE setting. There was I remember in 97, they once aired the footage on Raw once, and it was... I mean, at that time, I was, you know, 13 years old, and I didn't really get it.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't understand what the whole big deal was. And you look back, I mean, this was only in 96. You watch it now, I mean, this just... it's amazing that this was an outrage at the time. But 1996 was a lifetime ago. It was very different in this business, where... for those that maybe haven't seen the documentary and have just heard the term the curtain call, it was Nash and Hall's final night. They were doing a house show at Madison Square Garden. It was the biggest gate that they had ever done at MSG for a non-televised event. So it was, you know, a very big moment for the company, who was getting murdered at that time by WCW. The NWO was just getting set to kick off. So it was the beginning of a really down period for the WWF. They weren't really doing that well for the preceding couple of years. And earlier in the night, I believe it was... Scott Hall and Triple H worked together, and then Nash and Michaels headlined the show in a cage match. And at the end of the night, the four of them got into the ring. Waltman wasn't there, so it was just the four of them, and they all hugged. And it was just met with so much anger by especially the older guard that just saw this as such a violation of kayfabe at the time, that we had heels and baby faces celebrating in the ring. They had just fought each other earlier that night. And the fallout was Hall and Nash were off to WCW. Michaels was the champion at the time, so he was somewhat untouchable. And all the heat fell on Hunter at the time. And it's been talked about many, many times, the fact that Hunter was earmarked to win the King of the Ring that year. As a result of this, that was pulled. Austin wins the King of the Ring, which turned out to be a big starting off point for that character.
He was going to have a program with Shawn as well, he revealed.
Yeah, he was supposed to work with the champion, so all of that was taken away. It's somewhat been overblown, this idea that for the next year he was just booked into oblivion. The fact was, by the end of the fall, by the end of the summer, they put the Intercontinental title on him. They had paired him with Mr. Perfect. They were going to do a program with Hennig and Hunter before Hennig jumped over to WCW and left the company. So, I mean, it wasn't like Hunter was just, you know, flailing away for too long. And by 97, they brought in China, which is a big turning point for him. They kind of discuss in the documentary.
They made China look fantastic here. Pushed her really well.
I personally would have liked to have heard from her here. I mean, but for obvious reasons, they didn't. But nonetheless, I think she would have been an interesting voice to hear from.
Like, I was wondering how deep they would get, you know, whether or not they talk about their actual relationship and how, you know, that kind of led into the whole Stephanie deal. But
they were very careful in this that they... Did they even mention that Hunter and China had a relationship?
No, not at all.
They didn't even mention that, much less the fact that when Stephanie and Hunter were getting together, Hunter was still with China.
Yep.
So that part, the infidelity was, I guess, curiously omitted from...
That'll be the China DVD.
Yes, well...
The second one.
Okay, because her last DVD...
Yeah, no.
She definitely made up with Hunter.
Yeah,
felt
she
like.
Did. Yeah. In the whole locker room.
Yeah, coincidentally, that one also called Thy Kingdom Come.
Yeah.
Yes. So they talked about China coming in. This was after Mr. Perfect had left. He had that Lloyd's of London policy. He would then show up in WCW. So at this point, when he was paired with China, I mean, this was when the character at least started to, I won't say become, you know, main event star, but he was at least having some traction at this point.
Yeah.
Before, he was kind of just being given a lot of different props, lots of gimmicks, and it wasn't really clicking with people till China, for whatever reason, they seemed to have a good dynamic with one another.
He had Sable, too, at one time, but that was, you know, more of a case of, like, Sable being the attraction, like almost like Summer Rae and Fandango. Triple H was really the guy in the background. But, you know, at what point did he actually get rid of the accent?
It would have been somewhere in 97. I think it was right around that time where it was like you saw the evolution from the Greenwich Snob character into the DX Hunter. Right. And there was kind of this crossover where it was like he was still wearing the same outfit, but as he aligned with Sean in that summer of 97, that was when you started to see the transition.
It's like how he got rid of the Boston accent. Just like it melted away somehow.
Yeah, well, he's a man of a number of accents, I guess, and just kind of goes through them every
Did
now
you
and
hear
then.
Him attempt the fake French accent as Jean-Paul Levesque?
Horrible.
So bad. So bad.
And they came up with that idea in
game. Oh, I know.
So, like,
I know. It was flair.
Yeah, terrible.
Yeah.
Just terrible. So this was takes us into 97. The WWF, it should be noted, they really stressed how they were very much opposed to the idea of China. And I can't...
Vince
was very much against it. And I can't say that that's crazy. Like, you look at this on paper, it's like, we're going to have this muscular woman that's going to beat up guys.
I don't think so. I think it's awesome.
I thought it was weird at the start. I didn't think it was going to work. I thought this was going to be the latest weird idea for Triple H.
I do understand that. And we've seen, like, later on, you know, we've seen it with, like, Nicole Bass or Asia and WCW. How this gimmick won't work. But for some reason, I thought it just really clicked with China.
Did you know the, it's kind of self-explanatory, but Asia.
Obviously, yeah.
How clever.
Yeah.
Even with the Y. Remember when Ys were substitutes for I?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, very clever. So DX forming in 1997, that was obviously a big turning point for Hunter. He was paired with Shawn Michaels, and for the first time in his career, you got to see his personality, his actual personality, come out. Him and Shawn played off each other very, very well. And Hunter was really becoming an instrumental force here. I mean, he had a very significant play in how Montreal worked itself out. I mean, it was Shawn who was, you know, he was presented with the idea of putting Brett over, and it was going to Hunter, where Hunter was adamant, no, you cannot lose to this guy. Yeah. That he was certainly working behind the scenes here, which culminated in the great Triple H Julie Hart confrontation on Wrestling with Shadows.
That's right. And I just laugh at that, because that's something that they even decided to reenact in the video game. Like the WWE 13 video game in the Attitude Era mode.
Yeah.
There's actually a scene backstage of Hunter talking to Shawn. And it's just so funny to see, like, this real-life situation played out by these very stiff-looking video game models, like, of Hunter saying, he wants you to do this, screw him, yada, yada, yada.
It's too bad they didn't get Julie Hart in the video.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Yeah, you laugh. God's gonna strike you down.
What goes around comes around.
She was like the best promo of the whole Hart bunch of, but yep. in 97, I thought.
Yeah.
Julie Hart.
Yeah.
DX forming was obviously a big turning point for him at that point, and then they kind of take us through the, I guess, into DX 2.0 at the time when Shawn was out with the back injury that he suffered at the 98 Rumble. He mm-hmm. gutted it out through WrestleMania that year, putting over Austin very reluctantly at the time. The guy still didn't want to put over Austin, even as he was facing career-ending back injury. But with Shawn gone, that night after WrestleMania 14, to me, one of the most important Raws in history. I mean, that was the first time, a Raw the night after. It really was the reset of mm-hmm. here's the year to come. It was so key, I think. With Shawn gone, it put the focus on all these new talents. And you had Triple H come out, and he instantly brought back Shawn Waltman. By the end of the night, the Road Dogg and Billy Gunn were back, aligned with DX at the time. And it was really the kickoff of, you know, the WWF's rise at that point. It was only a few weeks later that they would beat Nitro in the ratings. And DX was a huge part of that 1998-99 boom period at the time, and Triple H was now positioned as one of the top babyfaces in the company, but still not the number one guy.
They portrayed it here in the documentary as if, you know, to say that when Shawn left, you know, DX could have just crumbled, it could have been nothing, it could have been Triple H with China, maybe with some other replacement, and it could have completely failed and fumbled, but instead, this guy Triple H was, you know, basically given the ball and was able to take it to even greater heights than they achieved with Shawn. So, yeah, like you look in hindsight and you know, a group usually without its leader ends up being worse than before. But Shawn did, or Triple H in the WWE in this case, did manage to not only keep it going but to make it something even greater.
Hunter was, I mean, this was really his, the focus being placed upon him, and you had Austin and McMahon as your top feud, but I mean DX and the feud with the Nation at that time, I mean that was such a big part of the program. Like every week you looked forward to what the DX segment of the week was going to be. They go over the big the Norfolk, the invasion angle where they got into the tank and went to Nitro, mm-hmm. which was you know, a very important, I think that whole angle is kind of, you know, they play that up as that was the turning point in everything. Like,
not really.
You know, we literally ended the war with a tank and, you know, it was very cool.
It fit the story very well.
Yeah. And, you know, Hall and Nash, they've always said that the smartest thing WCW should have done was allow them to drive that tank onto Nitro, because their numbers would have shot through the roof, which they would have at the time.
Yeah, they would have, but at the same time, what do you do? Like, what do you do? Like, you can't have guys just, you know,
you send out Ming to beat the shit out of them.
Yeah, I suppose so. Then you have a lawsuit on your hands.
It'd be great for everybody involved.
Yeah, it would be.
Were you watching at that time in 98?
No, I was not.
Because I can tell you, at that time when I was 14, and that to me was the height of people around me, like at school, watching wrestling. And suddenly it's like, wow, you people know what DX is. And, you know, people were showing up in like eighth grade with like DX shirts and stuff. And it was such a popular time.
It was at about the same time that South Park started to gain popularity. And so, yeah, I was just starting high school at this time, and all of a sudden, like, I had stopped watching wrestling by that point, but then all these people were like, wrestling. I'm like, really? Wow, you guys are into this stuff. Like,
I wonder how we would have reacted, like, if that time period came along now, where it's like, I think if we went back and watched a lot of the DX stuff, I think being 14 at the time, I enjoyed it a lot more because of me being 14.
You know, we talk about that a lot, you know, about how maybe the Attitude Era wasn't as great as, you know, we all remember, because, you know, but yeah, like, that stuff was booked perhaps for a different audience. But at the same time, you got to realize,
point was, it worked at the time too. Like, it wasn't like they were just simply feeding off of a one segment of their demographic. It was like everyone was digging this product at the time.
And you also just have to realize what came before and how, you know, boring and kind of generic everything that came before, or cartoonish what came before all that stuff was. And you know, take that into account of how different and how refreshing it was to even get some of this.
Yeah, they do play up in the documentary kind of the professional rivalry between Triple H and The Rock. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, not simply just recapping their on-screen feud, but as well, these were two guys that were jockeying for the same position in the company at the mm-hmm. time. And I don't know about you, but I've always felt that, you know, Triple H came around at a time when you were talking about, like, Austin and Rock were just, like, once-in-a-generation performers, yeah. and he was competing with both of them for that spot, and it was always kind of Triple H was the clear number three of those three at the time.
I don't even know about that. I would put McFoley in that role.
Yeah, McFoley, I would actually place at number... I think, historically, you'll look at maybe Hunter...
Hunter didn't really have his ascent until, like, you know, about 2000,
yeah.
when Foley was already on his way out. But, you know, it's amazing when you look back and think about all the talent that was in that company at that time. Like, that's a perfect way to describe it. Once-in-a-lifetime performers in The Rock and Steve Austin, both climbing up at the same time. And on top of that, you had Mick Foley, you had Undertaker, you had, you know, Triple H.
Yeah, you had so much talent that was over in 99.
But how much of that do you think, you know, was a result of the company giving them that space to grow? Because here, it seemed like these guys were given a lot of autonomy to create their own storylines, propose their own angles.
I think a lot of it was. I think if you went back to 1999, a lot of it was just allowing these guys to kind of find those characters and kind of work within those parameters. And it wasn't, I mean, this was well before the era of, you know, scripted promos and
yeah.
everything being so rigid, which I think somewhat does handicap a lot of performers from finding that.
Right, and do you think that, you know, if... I don't exactly know how much freedom is limited to the roster today, but let's say this, you know, today we were experiencing a similar level of freedom given to performers that they had back then. Do you think we would see more talents come up like The Rock, like Stone Cold, like Triple H, or is it simply a matter of there being more genuine talent back then?
I like to believe that I think the top talent is going to navigate through whatever material they're given. I think that, you know, if, you know, the handcuffs were off right now, I think, yes, you'd get, I think, a quicker route to stardom for certain guys. At the same time, you'd see some guys just falling on their face on live television who, let's be honest, there's some guys, they are not funny. They are not the smartest people when it comes to the idea of what you have to do to get over. Mm-hmm. And I think that you would see the good and the bad. It's not simply, you know, we get rid of scripted promos and suddenly everybody's over because they all have these creative juices flowing. I think that there's a select few that it would certainly help. But then there's others who I think they rely on scripted material and having, you know, a set script of what they have to deliver, and that's a comfort for them.
Yeah.
Into 99, they go over the split of DX at the time when, I mean, they were super hot at the time. They were selling so much merchandise, but the decision was made to split them up, and this is where you hear from Billy Gunn, who was very much opposed to this idea of splitting them up at the time, because I think he saw...
That was his meal ticket.
Yeah, and, you know, Billy Gunn would get a push coming out of that split. I mean, he would win the King of the Ring that year, but that would about be the high point of his post-DX career, I think, outside of Billy and Chuck, where he had a tremendous, you know, 6 months with Chuck.
Don't forget the James gang.
Oh, yes, of course.
Or Cute Kid.
The Voodoo Kin Mafia.
Yeah.
Remember them?
Yeah.
So they go over the split and...
Well, how did you feel at the time? Did you feel that it was too soon to split up DX? Or?
You know, they were still really hot, but at the same time, I thought that, you know, there was... You know, they had done so much at the time that I thought Hunter had somewhat outgrown the group, and when they turned him heel, it felt like the natural progression for this guy.
Yeah.
And in 1999, you sort of saw the others just kind of try to find where they... It was really, it benefited Hunter the most. And by the end of the year, they put them all back together as a heel unit at the time, which didn't have the same chemistry.
It really just felt like Hunter, like... just stopped caring about the rest and just kind of, you know, let them flounder, because that split even was, it seemed to be handled really weirdly. Like, Hunter was you know, in the corporation, but then we don't know if the others were, and then for a time it was just DX with those three guys. Even the split, the way it was handled was really strange.
Yeah, they really tried to go with Billy Gunn, but he just did not connect. I mean, he won the King of the Ring, but he's one of those like King Mabel winning, not one of those King of the Rings where you can look at and say, yeah, that really made him.
Yeah.
So then they were placed back together as the heel team. And this was also where Hunter finally got the title. It was the night after SummerSlam, which was a weird deal that they went over here where Jesse Ventura was the guest referee at SummerSlam. They turned it into a three-way. It was supposed to be Austin and Hunter in a singles match. Austin was hurting at the time. They put Mick Foley in, so Foley wins the title, and then 24 hours later drops the title to Hunter to avoid Hunter pinning Austin.
That's so weird.
Well, it was done for a bunch of reasons. I mean, one being that, you know, Jesse Ventura coming in, Ventura didn't want to be associated with, like, putting the heel over. And as weird as that sounds,
so stupid.
But nonetheless,
are you kidding me? Like,
he was the governor at the time.
He didn't want to raise the arm of the bad guy.
That was the story that came out at the time.
TV show.
So Hunter's rationalization was that more people saw him win the title on Raw than they did on the pay-per-view. But that's always something that guys use as a justification.
Yeah, that's just him like looking at the silver lining,
but
I think.
No one ever remembers a random Raw than a pay-per-view.
Yeah, well, I mean,
in the grand scheme of things, it didn't matter. It really didn't matter.
No, how many people even remember Hunter's first title win?
Well,
right now,
that first title reign was not exactly a memorable one.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting part to look at, is that, you know, this idea that, you know, Hunter broke away from DX, became this great heel, won the title, and he was off to the races was not accurate at the time, because he really struggled when he won the title. No one took him as that top guy.
Mm-hmm.
He was given just an enormous push, but the people just kind of took this guy as being shoved down their throat. They didn't take him in that role. He only held the title for a couple of weeks before dropping it to Vince McMahon, of all people, then would win it back. And it wasn't until 2000 and that feud with Mick Foley where that was the first time, at least for myself, where I looked at this guy as the top guy in the company.
I was really surprised that that wasn't more emphasized, because, yeah, I agree with you. To me, that was really the point where he became a main eventer, and they didn't really talk about that at all here.
It's such a weird, you know, much like Vince McMahon and Jim Ross have this weird relationship, so do Triple H and Mick Foley. And Mick Foley sung Hunter's praises on this documentary, but, you know, from stuff we've heard, it's that, you know, Hunter will not go out of his way and say anything bad about Foley, at least publicly, but privately you hear other things where I think Hunter, to a degree, I think he looks back and says, listen, I was a top guy, I looked like a top guy, and I think there's people who say, you know, Mick Foley was the bigger star of the two.
Yes.
And I think he takes it as a negative when people bring up that Foley made him. And to me it was, you know, Hunter was well on his way, and Mick Foley was that final program that people looked at and it's like, this guy is a top heel.
Yeah.
And universally, I think people look at that program as the turning point for Hunter's career.
Yep.
That match at the Rumble and the following month at No Way Out, I mean, fantastic matches. It was a tremendous program. Foley had no ego about keeping the heat on himself. It was all about making Hunter, and he did it.
Yeah.
So that was, and the year 2000 to me was, for me at least, was Hunter's best year as an in-ring performer. Mm-hmm. I mean, for people that want to talk about the negatives of Hunter in the ring, I mean, the guy's a tremendous worker, and that year he put together an unbelievable body of work.
Oh, and even in the early part of 2001, leading up to the quad tear,
when
he had that series with Austin. Yeah, some tremendous stuff.
Yeah, it was great. 2000 was also the year where Austin was out with the neck injury, and that's where Rock and Hunter were really relied upon as your top babyface and top heel, and they kept business super hot at the time. And as much as you want to say, you know, you had the Rock there and the company was hot, you still needed a big heel, and Hunter deserves, you know, as much credit as Rock to me for that year in 2000, where those were the top two stars in the world at that time. And then you go into 2001, Austin comes back in late 2000, and it seemed that the idea was that they were going to turn Austin, and Hunter would be the big baby face coming out of WrestleMania, but instead we got that two-man power trip where you had Austin and Hunter aligned with one another, and your baby faces were Undertaker and Kane. And business really took a dive after that year's WrestleMania.
It was not only those two, eventually they would go to Benoit and Jericho as well.
And I look back at that time, I mean, I think that was a opportune time to turn Hunter, and for whatever reason, it didn't happen. Like
against Austin?
Well, they had set it up. Remember that No Way Out pay-per-view right before Mania? Hunter beat him clean in that 2 out of 3 falls match.
Yeah,
it seemed that was the natural program.
I just wonder how that would have played out, because Austin.
I think it would be the fans would have wanted a flip.
Like, oh yeah,
they wanted to boo Hunter and they wanted to cheer Austin. Yeah.
And I often wonder how would have played out if Triple H was around during the invasion. What role he would have played in there. But we neglect to mention the whole wedding.
Oh, I'm just looking at this. I'm like, yeah. We did skip over the wedding. And we see Teth's face for like all of 5 seconds in this program, which is about how he's historically remembered. Because that was a program where they could have made Teth. And instead, he was like the useless boyfriend, and it was Vince McMahon who ended up having the big match for revenge, defending his. It wasn't Test who had the big match with Triple H at the end of the day, it was Vince.
Yeah.
And Test was, to me, he never recovered from that program.
Yeah, but I mean, I thought Test was maybe a bit too green for something like that.
Yeah, he might have been.
You know, like, he didn't really have anything on the mic. His in-ring was not at the level. I thought what
I would have at least tried versus doing. They did a 30-minute main event at the Armageddon pay-per-view that year with Vince and Hunter, and it was dreadfully bad.
Right.
I hated that match.
Yeah, I mean, Tess just didn't get over. But conversely, I thought this Hunter program, I was surprised to hear that, you know, the way they ended up booking it was because Vince didn't really even have an idea on how to end this Tess Stephanie deal. And
Hunter came up with the idea of, what if I drug and rape your daughter?
Yeah.
And Vince, yeah. God damn it.
And, like, that's so strange because in a roundabout way, he ended up booking his own real-life marriage. Like, what if that had never happened, you know? Like, Hunter and Steph would have never worked together, and they would have never gotten close, and none of this would have happened.
Well, their moms could have told them about their chemistry because their moms were the first ones to realize this.
Well,
Linda McMahon and Hunter's mom.
But not if they had never worked together.
This part of the... They show the angle. It was November of 99.
Oh, classic.
The Staples Center in L.A., a very famous angle where Test and Stephanie are getting married. Hunter comes out with, like, this rose on his lapel, just looking like the creepiest guy. And he shows the video where he has Stephanie drugged. They go through the tunnel of love and then tells Vince, the only question is how many times we consummated the marriage, insinuating that, yes, he, in fact, raped this woman.
Yeah.
But they were working against Vince, so it was consensual in the end. But that put Hunter and Stephanie together, and then we got, like, this uncomfortable 15 minutes.
Hey, this was my favorite part of the documentary.
This was gross.
Oh,
it was like they interviewed all these wrestlers about... Tell us about Hunter and Stephanie's love story. And we got stories of Big Show's wife spotting them making out in a department store like they were 15-year-olds. It was uncomfortable.
They were talking about how, yeah, like you mentioned, both of their parents were the first to notice some actual chemistry between the two. And then Vince eventually was told about it, and Vince actually gave them permission because obviously it was very much frowned upon for anybody to date Stephanie. Stephanie was barred from dating any of the wrestlers. But eventually Vince gave his blessing.
But then took away his blessing.
Yes, when he, you know, this was also...
do know the man changes his mind.
Yeah, but this was, I thought, a really interesting part about the dynamic of Triple H that I hadn't really considered before. I mean, as a fan, you look on from the outside in, and everybody has the same kind of initial perception, like, oh, okay, here's a guy really just wanting to date this the boss's daughter, kind of, you know, and wanting to take over the business himself. That's why he's really in it. And this perception was not only, you know, what the fans believed, but it was clearly something that they were aware of as well. And it's something that Triple H and Stephanie and everybody was very conscious of, and to the point where everybody was warning Triple H, you know, you might really like this girl, but keep in mind, no matter what you do from now on in your career, everybody's going to think that you know, you're handed it because... simply you're the boss's boyfriend. All these people are going to say these things to you. Are you going to be okay? And the most poignant part of the documentary for me was Stephanie saying, Hunter, even though he, you know, he was opening himself to so much criticism, he was willing to throw out this whole all the hard work he's put into his career for me, and that is the most romantic thing I've ever heard.
It is so sweet too. I brought a tear to my eye, actually. Yeah. In fairness, like, for all the people that, you know, look at, you know, Hunter here, of what he gains by this, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, put himself in a situation that very easily could have been detrimental to himself.
For a guy that worked that hard to get to where he was actually risking a lot. Yeah.
So, I mean, they just spend so much time on this, right down to Undertaker saying it was a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was really interesting that Hunter, you know, said that he realized for the rest of his career he is always going to have an asterisk next to everything he did.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I feel that this guy does get, he gets a lot of criticism because of that position.
He was getting it before, too, though.
Yeah, but you can definitely look at the fact that, yes, he gets a lot of he's an extremely talented performer. At the same time, that guy has been given lots of opportunities that, I mean, we're just coming off Sunday where it was pretty clear that, okay, we've tried with Daniel Bryan for 2 months. It's not where we want. We're going to slot him back, at least for now, into the mid-card, where, you know what, in the fall of 99, Hunter was very much in that same position, where he was not that over as the top heel with the title.
Oh, wait a second, though. Daniel Bryan is way more over than Hunter ever was.
Hunter was over.
Hunter never had, I mean, he was a
different
heel.
Different dynamic, where babyface and heel.
But look at the reaction to Daniel Bryan. I mean, for whatever reason that they don't want to push Daniel Bryan, it's clearly not due to crowd reaction, because that's the one thing he does have.
He does have a crowd reaction, but at the same time, it's like, you know, people popping in an arena can't be your be-all, end-all. It's not like this guy has spiked any kind of numbers. He's also, you know...
Who has, though?
You know, and that's a great point. This might be very different. Had Daniel Bryan been in this position back in the spring, as opposed to right when football came back on Monday nights, you're dealing with a three-hour show that, you know, Raw numbers are, you know, they are what they are, doing a 2-8 every week. And pay-per-view as a whole, there's very few people that are going to move pay-per-view at this point. So, I mean, you're just looking at the example was brought up in this documentary, the fact that when you're that top guy, you essentially have a gun to your head full of bullets, and you just have to avoid people putting a bullet in your head and not giving them a reason to.
Yep, and by dating Stephanie, he gave everybody the ability to throw a bullet in there.
So this part leads into our favorite part, the wedding.
Yes.
The wedding of weddings on October something or other, 2003. We're here on the 10-year anniversary of the royal wedding between Triple H and Stephanie McMahon, which coincidentally every person interviewed said it was the greatest wedding ever.
Could have been.
Looked fun. Yeah. Pat Patterson and Michael Hayes singing.
Yeah.
Wish I could hire them.
Yeah, could have been. On October 23rd, of course.
October 23rd.
10-year anniversary just passed.
Oh.
10 years already.
Unbelievable.
This was, it was amusing to me because this was Triple H back in his, like, when he was the world heavyweight champion and had his goatee shaved off. He just looked like such a douche.
Oh, we got to tell the story about the priest who got a copy of WWE Magazine.
Right.
And read about, there was some article on the history of Hunter and Stephanie, and he read it thinking it to be fact, and then told the family that, I can't marry these two.
They were already married.
They were divorced,
and he drugged her.
This almost sounded like a bullshit story, yeah. But I hope it's true.
But yeah, the wedding... It was,
we saw Shawn Michaels was one of the groomsmen. William Regal was there.
Mm-hmm.
A wrestling contingent.
It was, to me, why this is my favorite part of the documentary is because you get to see these figures and, you know, Sir Triple H among them. Vince McMahon, Stephanie, people that seem to never open up about their personal lives at all, completely open up here. You know, talking about their families, their childhood, like their love lives, you know, like just opening up into the very private details about who these people were. That's why I found this so revealing.
There was one great thing that I skimmed over when we were talking about Vince taking his blessing away from the two dating, was they went to this cutaway of some angle where Vince and Stephanie are in the ring and Stephanie's got this pouty face, like they just made some announcement and Hunter is just seething mad as they're describing Vince taking away the blessing. Let's get some B-roll to cover this.
In slow-mo. Yeah,
I'm amazed at some of the stuff that this production crew, think of the millions of hours of footage they have and just having it down to a science of just finding the perfect shot, the perfect soundbite for a lot of this. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, this is, it would be unbelievable to just shadow a WWE production crew during the making of one of these biographies of how they put it together,
yeah.
getting all this footage, tracking all of it down, and you know the story they want to tell. It's that part is always fascinating to me on these DVDs, and I'm sure they had the crew working overtime on this particular one. I guess we could fast forward here to the quad tear in May of 2001 on that edition of Raw that we have reviewed in the past, and pretty much taking him out. At that point, you know, his peak at that time as an in-ring performer, mm-hmm. to many, the best worker in the business at that time. It was a real big loss to the WWF at that time, losing Hunter and that depth issue. And he essentially picked up everything, moved to Birmingham, Alabama to rehab, and came back. And I don't know if he was ever quite that level that he was in 2000, 2001. I mean, that's still, he's a guy that I've always thought is a very talented worker, but to me, that 2000, 2001 period, I don't know if that's ever been matched on a night-in, night-out basis.
I mean, still had some great matches.
He had some great ones.
Even recently with Taker.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I just mean in terms of that guy.
How smooth he was, how consistent he was.
And he also, the comeback in 2002, that guy put on so much weight when he came back, and I mean like muscle weight that did slow him down in the ring. I mean, he looked like he had his own zip code when he came back, and they show him returning at Madison Square Garden.
They play that moment in full pretty much, because that was a big moment in the guy's career.
How often do we reference those U2 videos? I mean, that was the template of a comeback.
Yep.
And that to me is something that in wrestling is sometimes a blessing, when you can disappear and you come back and it's like you have this fresh coat of paint.
Yeah.
And I just saw actually a photo of Sheamus, and he shaved off his beard. His sideburns are all gone now. No mustache. He's just completely clean shaven now.
Still got the red hair?
I couldn't see because he was wearing a hat. But, you know, he's the same, where I think that character really has reached its limit.
Yeah.
It's very one-dimensional. So, I mean, he's going to try and put a spin on things when he comes back. I don't want the goofy Irish guy. I want, you know, okay, I get it. You're Irish. I don't need you to be wearing green and having red hair. It's like, you know, Chris Jericho's Canadian, and so, you know, I don't need to have you bringing down a flag and waving it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, or
like, how about you're a great character that happens to be of this descent?
Yes.
So, you know.
Yeah.
As Wei has his Property of Shanghai t-shirt on.
Yeah, I am a Chinese person.
What did you think of the return for Hunter? Because he came back, and it seemed like he had the greatest program in the world.
Yep.
The guy who injured him has stolen his woman, and they're going to headline WrestleMania. And instead, it was like the shittiest main event WrestleMania program I've ever seen.
Yes, unfortunately. And much of that I think you can attribute to the actual writing of the program.
It was horrendous.
I mean, everything seemed to be lined up perfectly between January to WrestleMania. The guy makes his comeback at the Rumble, wins, and then goes on to WrestleMania.
It was such an easy story to tell.
Yeah,
which frustrated
it does, but
me.
You can never predict the reaction of the crowd to it. And with somebody like Triple H, certainly the crowd was taken to him, but there's always a feeling of like, oh, you know, this is just the company forcing this guy onto us.
I thought the negative was that the heat was Hunter versus Stephanie, and it was like Jericho was just the errand boy for Stephanie.
And yeah, absolutely. Jericho definitely did not seem like a big enough threat. I mean, you also had the problem of Brock versus Hogan there.
Yeah.
Basically, you know, taking all the wind out of that main event.
And it wouldn't be the only time that Hunter would be in that position at a WrestleMania where they had to follow something spectacular and they couldn't.
And I think I also just feel that Hunter is a much more natural heel. He's an excellent heel. As a babyface, you know, he's good. Yeah, on a comeback, yeah, you definitely have to have him as a babyface. But I thought he was way more effective afterwards as a heel.
The comeback for Hunter, it was handled so well, and it led to the Rumble 2002 that did 670,000 buys. To this day, that's the most purchased Rumble in history. And there is no disputing who drew that number. It was Triple H and his comeback.
I found it interesting that they, you know, they talk about his title win at WrestleMania 18, and then the VO basically says he went on to hold the World Heavyweight Championship for 9 months. And they basically decided to combine his big gold belt reign during the brand split with this undisputed title.
Yeah, he would actually hold the undisputed title for about 5 weeks and lose it to Hulk Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
We skimmed over so much stuff in 2002 where he got the big belt. No necrophilia, no Katie Vick mention.
Oh, yeah. Those are some other highlights of his career. I don't know. Maybe that'll be the Kane DVD.
Yeah, and, you know, as much as, you know, he draws that Rumble number, but it was then, you know, from 2002 until, like, 2000...
Evolution.
Yeah, until John Cena really became cemented as the number one guy. I mean, Hunter became the most pushed guy in the company. And quite often, there was a lot of resistance during that time.
Oh, my God.
With Austin and Rock gone, and believe me, this is where a lot of criticism, I think, is somewhat validated, because if that guy was somebody else, I think they would have brought him down the card and not had him in that top position. You had the Undisputed title at the time. They made Brock, and then a week later, they bring this other title out for Hunter and somewhat watered down the Undisputed aspect of that top title. And what the brand split was really built around was like this champion who was above both brands and could go back and forth.
Right. And this was also during the brand split where Raw was definitely the weaker show of the two. You had the fantastic SmackDown 6 era, but on Raw you had the Triple H-led, I don't know, sort of shitty wrestling gimmicky show.
That was their... It was the good wrestling and the shitty storylines. Yeah. That was the juxtaposition of Raw and SmackDown in 2002. Mm-hmm. They go into kind of evolution forming where Hunter felt that Ric Flair was kind of at rock bottom, which he'll pretty much admit that he was just, you know, his confidence was shot and Hunter really wanted to lift him up. And they never mentioned this, but Mark Jindrak was actually going to be a part of evolution at the start, and they just weren't happy with his performances at the live events.
Who was he to, like, was he to join the four, or was he supposed to, was he replaced eventually by somebody?
The vignettes they shot were with Hunter, Flair, Orton, and Jindrak. Oh. So it looks like Batiste inherited his role.
Okay.
I believe that's how it went. I don't think it was going to be a five-man group. Right. And it's really hard to argue. I mean, Mark Jindrak would have a lot of success in Mexico, continues to this day. But, I mean, Orton and Batista, I mean, they got behind these guys. Yeah. And as much as everyone thought Orton was going to be the breakout star, I mean, I felt that both guys, you know, really... You know, to me, Hunter and Batista was... That's the program I look at that was Hunter's legacy in terms of making a guy. And... As you look back at this guy's career, when you're looking at who did Hunter make, it's like it's Batista, essentially. And he had a lot of chances to make guys, and for whatever reason, you know, the Rob Van Dams, the Jerichos, the Shelton Benjamins.
Booker T.
I mean, you can go on with a number of these guys. It's really Batista and that WrestleMania 21 show. It did 983,000 buys, and it was that feud was the main event, and I thought it was one of the best builds in company history. I mean, that they just built it up so well, just the way months before, just Batista giving that look to Hunter, very much kind of what they teased this week with Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose. It's almost like they're taking from that, the slow turn that's eventually going to happen.
Hmm.
So, I don't know. Anything you took from the Evolution days that was worth noting?
Well, I mean, kind of talking about how he got very close with Flair at the time. And, Randy and Batista kind of look up to the guy as, you know, a brother figure.
They fast-forwarded then to the WrestleMania 22 program with John Cena at the WrestleMania we were at, featuring Hunter's famous... four entrance.
When he came out, like, we were both, like, looking at
him. Got yelled at by the WWE guy in front of us. Remember that?
No, I don't remember.
You and I were just laughing hysterically.
Yeah,
we're
like,
entrance.
What the hell is this?
And some guy with the WWE was ahead of us, and he was just like, can you just be quiet? Or something like, I was like, dude, this is stupid.
Come on. The guy comes out in a fucking cape and a giant...
It was one of the most ridiculous entrances I've ever seen. And Hunter's had some really horrendous ones in his day.
Yeah.
But that program really did kind of put the stamp on John Cena. He was our guy at this point. And this was when Hunter was still certainly a top protected guy, but you didn't feel like he was the guy being pushed. It was now kind of Cena was our number one guy with Hunter as maybe 1A. And then after that, with Hunter out of the program, they eventually turned him, and it was the reunion of DX. And I don't know about you, Wei, but I hated this version of DX.
Vince loves cock.
Yeah, and, you know, Michaels kind of used the excuse as, like, oh, people got on us for trying to be hip. That was the point. We were supposed to be old. I'm like, yeah, but none of this was funny. I hated some of this stuff. It was so amateur, and I always hear people talk about, you know, the comedy of these two and how well they play off each other. I'm sorry, man. I never found these two funny together. I found it very forced.
The stuff in 97 was funny.
Maybe in 97, but in 2006, well, I just found it was just like It was humor that at least didn't speak to me, and maybe I'm in the minority.
No, exactly, and they make that point here. I was actually surprised that they would spend as much time as they did in this documentary talking about that DX reunion, because I remember it with such bad memories. But they basically make that same case that, you know, Sean was a much different person at that point, and they were really not looking to recapture the same type of DX that they were doing in 97. Instead, they were perhaps trying to cater to a different audience, but also they would try to explain it by them making fun of themselves and how they're not these young guys anymore making dick jokes. Now they're like almost 40-year-old men making these dick jokes, and how stupid that is.
These two also just had a penchant for when they were playing off of each other, just... I mean, whether it was the Spirit Squad, whether it was, you know, just whoever their random opponent was, I mean, they would bury some guys, you know? I mean, just, and that's to me, one of my biggest criticisms of Hunter is that it always seemed like the priority was always myself. Uh-huh. And if that meant, you know, saying some comment that was just, you know, this guy never drew a dime or whatever it was like Hunter, it wasn't one or two times. It was like, this is a pattern throughout his career of always taking digs at guys where it was not about business. It was just about placing the spotlight on yourself at the expense of your opponent. And I mean, that is a pattern throughout this guy's career. And I thought that during this DX portion, we saw so much of it. We played the clip off the top. I mean, the end of the Spirit Squad feud was these guys being thrown into a trunk labeled OVW. Yeah. And then when the guy asked if it needs insurance, they said, no, there's nothing worth a crap in this trunk. Mm. I mean, just no value to your opponent at all. And I think that, you know, you look at a lot of these programs, and this guy handicapped a lot of potential talent that, you know, for whatever reason, was deemed, no, this guy can't get over. He doesn't have this, he doesn't have that. And you just nitpick to the point that you really had a starvation when it came to creating new talent. Mm-hmm. Then we go to... The second quad tear. Yeah. At New Year's Revolution, January 07, when they were taking on Edge and Randy Orton. And this would take Hunter... he would miss WrestleMania that year, where he was supposed to headline against Cena for the second straight year. Instead, Michaels was put into that.
They pretty much glossed over this like it was a very little occurrence.
I think it was felt that, what can we do here that was different from the first quad tear? It's like the rehab story, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, he's already torn his quad.
Yeah. Been there, done that, torn this. So he came back at SummerSlam 07, where he just killed Booker T. Mm-hmm. And it was this program that I think Booker, he really soured on when he left WWE, and it was just, he got nothing out of this. It was just, Hunter was showing up to beat him. Very much like Cena Del Rio this past Sunday. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what this return was. And he moved to SmackDown.
Except with that, I see value in, you know, obviously giving Cena a championship. At this point, I don't think Triple H with the title or a win over Booker really meant anything.
Yeah, and this was, you know, his comeback here and into 2008 was when we got babyface He-Man Hunter, where this guy just ran through people. I thought his matches were very awkward as a babyface because A, of the size, he was just towered over some of his opponents, and it was so hard to have any sympathy for this guy who just, he killed everybody. He ran through everyone. And I don't think John Cena has that same issue, even though he, you know, at times is presented as superhuman. Like with Hunter, it was just, I just found it very troubling as a babyface.
I think it goes back to the same thing that you were talking about, how his number one priority seemed to be making himself seem like the best guy. And it just...
And that wasn't the case in 2000, where he went out on Raw once and made you believe Taka Michinoku was going to beat him clean. And it was just, you know, build up the babyface, build him up. He'd eventually go over, but he would sell his ass off to get that babyface over.
It's something that I feel like he doesn't really have anymore. I mean, that my opinion might change on that depending on the week, but I definitely do feel like there's a lot more insecurity at this point in his career.
We then go to the Randy Orton feud in 2009, where this thing started off tremendous. If you remember this angle where he punted Vince in the head right before the Rumble that year, I would say that was the most over I've ever seen Randy Orton. He was the biggest heel in the business coming off that angle, and it was significantly watered down because then he went into this program with Shane McMahon. They did like a 20-minute match on pay-per-view, like a 50-50 match, Randy Orton and Shane McMahon. That was just... I just thought it did so much damage to Orton. And then they go into WrestleMania that year where they had this infamous feud where it's perfectly accentuated by the home invasion, where Hunter shows up at Randy Orton's house, and they had this multi-camera shoot in the home where Hunter threw him through a window.
It's just funny because...
They built this up way... Like, they talk in reverence with this feud. It was one of the greatest feuds in company history. And the only handicap was that they had a bad stip for WrestleMania. Fact was, this match had so little interest by the time Mania came around. Like, no one cared.
Right.
And that was perfectly identified by this Houston crowd that sat on their hands for this main event that year in 09.
Well, they seemed to blame it on the fact that Shawn and Taker...
just had the greatest match ever.
Yeah.
And they had this stipulation where this was like this big grudge feud, and they put this stipulation on where if Hunter was DQ'd or counted out, he would lose the title.
Mm-hmm.
And a very stupid stip in hindsight, but... I mean, you guys came up with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's also funny to just see all that stuff with the home invasion, and then on Raw the next day, you see these three just are on one.
Well, as Hunter explained, he was a monster for a while. Yeah. He was Frankenstein's monster, but he matured.
Yeah.
To Hunter's credit, I mean, Orton kind of defends the match. He was very happy with it, but Hunter pretty much just writes it off. It was bad, and it didn't work.
Yep.
So, you know, credit where it is due there.
Mm-hmm.
They discussed a bit about Hunter's movie career.
Oh, my God. Why spend even the time? Why waste the film, the editing space, the DVD
room? It's there for
room.
Its own reasons. But
they spent so much time on this, the chaperone and all this stuff. Like, stuff nobody gives a shit
about. Did you catch his dig at Rock here, where Vince wanted them to meet with Endeavor in 2000, and Rock was jumping at the opportunity to do movies, whereas Hunter was the wrestler.
He didn't want to be a movie star.
Yeah. No. He made it very clear there.
But if he did want to, he could have probably done a great job at it.
They show him filming The Chaperone. One of his co-stars says his dramatic ability is already established from wrestling. And then he did another movie after, the name of which I have no clue.
Doesn't matter.
It doesn't really matter. And then really kind of the final chapter in terms of the in-ring was the two matches with Taker. And they pretty much presented this as like a four-year arc where it started with the two Shawn Michaels matches and ended with the two Hunter matches. And arguably... take your pick of what your favorite match was of those four. I will say this way, being live at the Hell in a Cell in Miami, that might have been the most heat I've ever experienced at a wrestling match live. It's that or Rock Hogan from 2002. It was to see this entire stadium on their feet for the false finishes. It was unreal.
Those four matches, I mean, even at that point in time, it was very hard to buy that anybody would have a chance of beating The Undertaker. Especially, you know, like Triple H, I'd never see them giving a win up for him. But
everyone believed it during the match.
They somehow managed to work a match to make everybody in that place believe that it could have happened. And that really is a great feat. And unfortunately, as great as CM Punk was, kind of ended the streak of, you know, all those great matches.
It was still very good. Probably, you know, if you're comparing it to the Michaels and Hunter matches, it's number five. But that, to me, was still stole the show at Mania. It was cool to hear from Undertaker here, where, you know, it's like he's such this mythical character that you almost have this disconnect that he's a real person. And he talks about, you know, the pressure is really high to top myself every year with these matches. And it's sometimes you forget that about this guy of like all the injuries he's got. And
I hear him talk about that, and I totally understand why he would have considered not coming back this year for that match, why he would have considered that you know, walking off of that set with Shawn and with Hunter, walking off the stage to be his final moment in the wrestling industry.
It's almost amazing, because I don't think that Hell in a Cell match, I don't think he could have done anything to make that match any better than it was. I mean, it was incredible. They show the three of them hugging on the ramp, and then some rare backstage footage of them hugging.
That was great.
Vince McMahon is in tears after this match.
Oh, Steph as well.
It was an incredible scene. Maybe the highlight of this documentary was just focusing on these matches.
I like the wedding, actually.
The wedding was pretty damn great. Then they transition into his executive role. This is where we hear from Brock about him launching NXT, but the Performance Center, working with Full Sail University. They show him coaching Bray Wyatt here out of character. Larry Zbysko even made a cameo here in the B-roll section.
Even Stevie Ray.
I missed Stevie Ray.
Stevie Ray was backstage, I think, at the NXT.
All right. Yeah. This whole chapter just emphasized how insanely busy his life is right now. And, I mean, there's no disputing that. And this was filmed back in, like, July. And you look at how involved he is now on television. Mm. He's keeping an insane schedule right now.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? If you're going to take over for the role of Vince McMahon, it's something I'm sure he's quite prepared for.
And then the final, like, 10 minutes, the wrap-up.
I thought this might have been more suited for an anniversary review because it looked like we were watching, like, a 10-minute blowjob here.
Well, all we know is that these final 10 minutes will be replayed the day Triple H passes away at his funeral because I don't think you can pay a bigger tribute to this man. Here are some of the gems from Billy Gunn. Sports entertainment, he's it. Great guy, great entertainer. William Regal goes so far as to say he is as good as anyone that's ever laced up the boots. Ever. Ever. Terry Taylor. It was never about him. It was about what made the company and business better. Stephanie says he stays on top because he changes and evolves his character, which is one argument I would say is not true about this man.
Yeah.
I've watched this guy wield a sledgehammer for about 14 years now with German iconography all over his shirts with a Jesus implication.
He's pretty much the same character. Cut his hair, though.
And Way, only one man that could close off this DVD. Uh-huh. Vince McMahon. He's one of the best things that has ever happened to me and the business. He's a good man.
Yeah.
Vince, not Stephanie.
Yeah. The whole time I'm watching this, and I'm just thinking, what the hell? I mean, first of all, even Triple H himself watching this must have been at some level...
I'd have to turn it off.
Sickened. Come on. This was, like, maybe like a little 2-minute thing. Cool. A little thing to end. This was like a fucking 10-minute thing of just these comments and the violin music underneath. Like, this guy some type of had triumphed over some evil. Like, you had thought that this was Gandhi or something. But man, 10 minutes of it was definitely overkill. The other part of me was just thinking, like, wow, like, that's why I think a comeback right now for Shane McMahon in storyline form would almost be perfect, because here's Vince McMahon basically talking about this guy seemingly with much more reverence than he would of his own firstborn son.
Very, very true.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll get the Shane DVD one day.
No, I doubt that.
Vince won't be interviewed for it. Interesting here, of all the names, no CM Punk.
Yeah. Who else was missing? Well, Punk wasn't really involved in the guy's career.
Yeah, when Punk was at his hottest, it was certainly Hunter that extinguished that program. Remember
why
that?
Would they interview Punk about that?
Well, I would. I was begging for some reality at some of these points. Like, listen, yeah. I don't want to say that, you know, Hunter was a bad performer. He really wasn't. But I think balance is, you know, well, whatever. If they're not going to do it,
there were some bad years. There,
like,
were some.
If
there
you
some
lived
bad
through
times,
this,
yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry, but Hunter, as much as the positives are there, equally, I think this guy really stunted the growth of this company with a lot of talent that, for whatever reason, was not deemed worthy. Whether it was, you know, the way he presented his challengers at times and just utterly burying guys on television. I mean, let's go no further than 2 weeks ago on TV in the line about Edge, Jericho, and Rob Van Dam.
Which you will hear Jericho talk about.
Oh,
on
this
the
Sunday
law.
Night. Interesting. Yes. What positive was there to that comment other than Hunter getting a cute line in for his own self? I mean, that doesn't build anything.
Well, I mean, it does get him a bit of heat, but I think it does...
But what kind of heat? Like, acknowledging that these guys were not stars? Is that what I take away from that?
The heat is that he is somebody who thinks so highly of himself that he looks down at people that other people, you know, the majority of fans see as great.
Well, at the same time, it's you're also identifying three people that held this title that this show is essentially built around and telling me that this title does not mean you're a star. I determine if you're a star.
Sure. Yeah.
And anyway, so that was Thy Kingdom Come, and now Thy Will Be Done.
What did you think of the DVD?
You know what? They certainly had a lot of people, but I just... it was uncomfortable at times of just how self, you know, congratulatory
And
you know what, Hunter, you know, to his credit, he was the guy that did bring up negatives.
Yeah.
It's not like this guy was pumping himself, it was everybody else. And I'm going to take most issue with Road Dogg and Billy Gunn, because I'm sorry, they just have no credibility in my books for guys that suit their opinions for the environment that they must live
yeah.
in.
Yeah, but what do you expect, though? These guys...
I don't expect anything else, have to be open to criticism
for
when
sure.
you're going to flip like
no
that.
No doubt. You know, but these two, I imagine, never expected to be back with the company when they made those comments. And now that they are back, they are going to do everything in their power to stay here. And that includes probably shutting up your true feelings or doing a complete 180 from what you're trying to say.
Whatever their reasoning was, whether it's, hey, we're going to talk shit about Hunter to get attention on ourselves, or we're going to talk up Hunter to... You know, for our own yeah. employment here, either one, it's, you know, you're contradicting yourself, and that's on the record, and you look foolish as yeah. a result.
I will say, like, there's no logical reason why anybody would look to a WWE-produced DVD for an unbiased look at Triple H. That's just impossible.
What are you talking about?
No, I just mean that is impossible from the get-go, because you're within the company, everybody... interviewed here is working for the guy that they're talking about. The only way you'd really
which
get
is,
something...
You know, to the viewer, it's like you have to be prepared for what you're getting into.
Absolutely.
What are you expecting here?
This is a Triple H fluff piece, no doubt. And that's... I mean, a lot of all these DVDs are. Let's be honest here. Except the Ultimate Warrior one, of course. But this... I personally enjoyed it just for a lot of the candid moments, it seemed, of you know, people like Stephanie, like Vince opening up about a lot of their personal lives. For me, I found it pretty entertaining throughout the whole thing. I definitely wouldn't look at it as, you know, like, the important thing about watching all these things is just, you know, go in, be educated, and don't take everything for face value, and, you know, I just found it entertaining to me.
To that end as well, I mean, you can look at this, you know, this is what it is with the WWE piece. I don't feel, though, that, you know, bringing up faults and bringing up obstacles that someone's gone through in their career is a negative. In fact, in most cases, I mean, to me, overcoming something, whether it be, you know, I was immature at this point in my career, or you know what, you know, just reflecting on one's own faults to a guy saying, listen, there was a time in my career where I was insecure about keeping that position. And, you know,
well, let's think about all the people who would have felt comfortable to say those things. I mean, Triple H himself, obviously, which he did a little bit. But you also had Vince, probably Steph, who could get away with that, Taker. But everybody else, like, who else is there?
I mean, you know, you name off the people that... I mean, it's just... you're right. This is not going to be the kind of... I'm just saying that, you know, if it's presented, I don't see it as a negative. In fact, I see it as a much more compelling
Absolutely.
Story
Yep.
when you have... I mean, one of the best things about the CM Punk documentary was that you had a side that was pro-Punk, and you also heard from the people in the office and on the creative team who were not fans of Punk, who didn't think that that guy could get over. And I think that that added a lot to the documentary, knowing that, you know, these people are standing by their beliefs. And that was a tremendously entertaining documentary that, to me, you watch that, and CM Punk feels like the biggest star in the world by the end of it.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to get into feedback over at lawradio.proboards.com. Let's start off with Ronaldo from Milan, Italy. I knew this review would come sooner rather than later, so here we go. It's a nice documentary. The new style WWE has implemented in making their documentaries is more of an analysis of the person behind the character. Makes for great stuff, but I won't take this as much more than a vanity project and a little companion piece to Triple H's current gimmick on TV. The guy will never receive a farewell like Flair, Hunter, or even Edge, Flair, HBK, or even Edge. So he went out and made his own DVD where coworkers and family members talk about how great he is at anything, basically. Don't get me wrong, I'm sure the guy loves his wife and kids and has a true passion for the business, but we're not reviewing the man, right? Funny how they skipped his relationship with China in favor of the Paul and Steph kissing under a tree version, but it is surprising considering his standing in the company and the fact his kids will probably watch this. Nice to see Taker break kayfabe to tell us what he thinks of Mick Foley, I mean Triple H. All hail the king.
Jay Hunter, welcome back, John. And... says, thanks, Way. Well, no problem, Jay. An enjoyable DVD despite the obvious self aggrandizing, and 10-minute Triple H is the bestest, most smartest, lovely dad boss montage at the end. It was smart to spin marrying the boss's daughter and inheriting the WWE empire as a gamble for love. He left out that he was living with and engaged to China at the time he was chasing Stephanie. I have no idea why they spent so much time swooning over this fake fairy tale courtship. Trips makes out the curtain call to be this historic massive burial. He was the IC champion 5 months later, which was a much bigger deal in 96. Do you think Triple H is ashamed to admit his feud with Foley in 2000 made his career, as it's barely mentioned? I'm not surprised they skimmed over his repeated demolition of any potential new stars from 2003 onwards, but they also gloss over making Batista's career in their excellent WrestleMania 21 storyline. From the DVD, you'd think he'd only had a handful of matches since his 2001 quad tear.
Derek from Denton, Texas. Welcome back, John Way. You did an awesome job hosting the podcast these last couple of weeks. I really enjoyed this documentary. I thought it was cool seeing Triple H actually getting in the ring at NXT in a suit, helping out the younger talent, practicing for their match. I also love how some superstars start off with the crappiest gimmicks at the start of their career, and they are able to break away from the gimmick into something so much better. I was pretty surprised seeing Lesnar in this documentary, even if it was for a pretty short amount of time. Both Triple H and Randy Orton talking about how they kind of dug themselves into a hole for the WrestleMania 25 match was also a nice touch. Overall, I thought this documentary was pretty good. I'm not sure I can say it's as good as Punk's, but still a damn good one. 8.5 out of 10.
Gaurav Kumar from India. I know John was only gone for 3 weeks, but finally having him back with Way feels nostalgic. This documentary was fantastic. Just as you thought the WWE production couldn't top Punk's documentary, they put on another masterpiece. I felt Triple H was really honest about everything. Watching the series of matches which he had with The Rock made me realize that Triple H doesn't really get credit for what he contributed to the Attitude Era. People always talk about Rock and Austin when the Attitude Era was mentioned, but Triple H was one of the driving forces behind the success of that era by being the most hated heel in the company, who got asshole chanted at him at every single show.
To Josh Kachenko, I wasn't really rushing to watch the doc, but I tracked it down at a discounted price. From a production standpoint, it was nearly flawless. From me giving a shit about Triple H standpoint, I'd rather watch 90 minutes of Satoshi Ishii, Jeff Monson than this documentary. And wow. Josh was at that M1 show.
Beautiful. Michael from Caledon. I got this DVD for my 22nd birthday, and I was a little disappointed. I thought this documentary would be about Triple H is God's gift to everything, but it isn't. This provides great insight into the man. Triple H wasn't the guy, but was a major player in the Attitude Era. I thought the match selection was awesome, and I don't think any of the matches have been released on other 3-disc sets. Loved rewatching the Iron Man match and his match with Shawn Michaels.
Tom from London. Welcome back, John. I'm sure everyone will agree. Way's done a great job in your absence of holding the fort down. For Triple H, I was pleasantly surprised by the documentary portion. It wasn't quite the Levesque love-in I had expected, and actually took a good long look at the man behind the character. The first 2/3 are so-so, largely due to the lack of any real perceived struggle for Hunter, curtain call-related punishment aside. However, the focus on his new role behind the scenes is fascinating, and while it may not have been as insightful or intriguing as the Punk DVD on a personal level, Thy Kingdom Come gives us a glimpse into the future of the biggest wrestling company on the planet, and what kind of impact Triple H will have on the direction of the industry in the future. I also really enjoyed the match selection on the DVD, which avoided crossing over too heavily with the previous King of Kings release, and it was nice to see some of his WCW work featured so prominently. A solid effort overall.
Alexander Rios. So it's time to review the Triple H DVD. The most shocking thing in this documentary is the fact that Vince owns an iPhone. Whoa, I thought Grandpa would still be using the rotary in the office. Okay, now onto my serious opinion of Thy Kingdom Come, the documentary on our King of Kings, Gods of Gods, and... okay. This thing, because I would say it was more of a love letter from the WWE to Paul Levesque, because in this thing it was all about how awesome he is. Doesn't smoke or drink, always has just the right thing to do when the booming minds get stumped. Randy Orton goes on about what a great brother he was to him, and how he, Shawn Michaels, and Undertaker's end of an era match with some kind of magic send-off, I guess. And then there's the wedding, the real one. I cannot believe that Vince McMahon was crazy enough to want to at some point air this on live pay-per-view. Who would have bought a pay-per-view to watch one of your WWE heels?
I would have, to just answer that question right away. I absolutely would have bought that pay-per-view.
And there you go.
Commentary with Jim Ross?
Oh.
I know!
He did it.
Martin from London. While not on the level of Punk's DVD, the Hunter documentary was a good look at what drives him and some of the issues that have come up with his career. Even though some topics get a lot of time, such as the formation of DX, his first quad injury, and his move into running the company, some get an absurd amount of time, such as how he and Stephanie got together and the WWE films he did. Topics such as Evolution, the Foley feud, and his 08 run on SmackDown get a shocking low amount of time. I chuckled when the SmackDown part discussed, quote, working with lesser superstars, and they showed The Miz and Jeff Hardy. One accusation that can be leveled at the film is the portrayal of Triple H as a massive superstar. And while he played an important role in the Attitude Era in most of the 2000s, much like he claims of Daniel Bryan, Chris Jericho, and Edge, he was never the top guy. To paraphrase Dave Meltzer, Hunter was, quote, the guy you paid to see the top guy beat rather than the guy. I have a worrying feeling that history over time may be rewritten to make Triple H a bigger deal than he really was. The talking heads on the documentary did nearly stray at times into audio fellatio, and it was pretty telling at points that only archived footage of Austin and Flair was used rather than fresh footage, and there weren't any contrasting opinions. The film is worth watching purely for a rare chance to see The Undertaker out of character, even coming up with the closest thing to a criticism on the DVD by saying that the original Hunter Hearst Helmsley gimmick was crap. For presentation and effort, I'd say 6 out of 10, although it would have got a 7 if they included footage of Michael Hayes at the wedding, but sadly, I can understand why they didn't.
Like, onto that, the topic of you know, being the top guy, that's always a spot that's reserved for the top baby face, never for the top heel.
Yeah, and I would say, I mean, in 2000, I mean, him and Rock were pretty much, you know, that baby face heel, and I wouldn't, you know, Rock was the bigger draw, but, I mean, Hunter was a really important part.
The top heel is just as important.
Absolutely was. And I think Hunter, to dismiss this guy as not a draw or not a star is just inaccurate. And that's going too far in the direction. And that's where I think the association with the McMahons hinders his legacy as much as it's helped it in other areas.
Finally, from the Skull Captain. I did see this documentary a while ago on the interweb, and I was left disappointed. After some very good recent docs on CM Punk, Austin, and Mick Foley, Thy Kingdom Come felt like a step back into the bad old days of approved WWE storytelling. I've never seen any other Triple H DVD, so it could be that the many items they missed out have been covered elsewhere, but I felt that they skipped over a lot to focus on the Paul Love Steph nonsense. Rick Rude was seen but not spoken of. China was spoken up, but only in a kayfabe way, ignoring the tricky personal stuff. Lots of his best feuds and matches were missed out, i.e. Rock, Shawn Michaels, and Cactus Jack. And if you had wondered why Stone Cold Steve Austin hasn't got an invite to Raw since Triple H has been in charge, then watch him tell the story about the SummerSlam 99 title match with Austin and Mankind. He clearly has a large chip on his shoulder because Austin wouldn't drop the belt to him.
Yeah, there's a lot more to that story than simply that. I mean, there was a lot of issues going on at the time that necessitated that finish. Beyond that, Rick Rude, I mean, that to me played.
Why would they mention that?
Absolutely no reason to. I mean, that guy had really played no part in Triple H's rise or anything like that. So I don't think you had to delve too much into the Rick Rude's, semi-month run in the WWE in 1997. All right, that's going to bring us to a close. Lengthy edition here of Review Away.
How lengthy?
It's about 2 hours at this point, roughly. So we will get on out of here. For next week, Way, are you ready for the month of November?
I think so.
Because it's always associated with one pay-per-view that stands above all of the rest.
What is it?
TNA Turning Point.
Yeah.
No, we're going to review next week, Survivor Series 1993. And, you know, you've been going out grabbing all these guests, so I thought next week we could have a guest on Review Away.
Who?
Well, SummerSlam 90, Survivor Series 93 featured a match between the Hart family, Brett, Owen, Keith, and our guest for next week, Bruce Hart.
What?
Against Shawn Michaels and Three Knights. That will be on display next week for Survivor Series.
Oh,
interestingly enough, Survivor Series 2013 will be from Boston, as was the 1993 version.
Wow, 20 years ago.
The Boston Garden in 93. So that is going to be our review, also featuring the All-Americans against the Foreign Fanatics.
Wow.
The Foreign Fanatics, led by Yokozuna.
Okay.
Accompanied by, oh God, who else was in that match? Ludwig Borga. The Quebecers. It's going to be a great time.
That's foreign.
Next week. So 20-year-old Survivor Series coming up next week that me and Way will review. Bruce Hart will be on the show. to chat about that match. Very interesting backstory, because if you recall, that was the start of the build for Bret and Owen for WrestleMania 10, which was originally supposed to be Bret against Bruce.
Ooh.
What happened? Find out next week on Review Away. Any final words, Mr. Ting?
I can't wait to talk to Bruce Hart.
Should be fun. That's going to be next week. As always, you can go to liveaudiowrestling.com. Subscribe to all of our shows. They are always free and available on iTunes. Just look for The Law, Live Audio Wrestling. You can leave us some feedback. You can follow Way on Instagram and Twitter, at Way0937. He can post photos on his phone. Me, you can simply go to Twitter, at IamJohnPollock, or at Law Radio. They're both me. Even when you send hurtful tweets to Pollock to the Law Radio account, not realizing I run that account, I take them just as personally. So thank you very much to the people who were one guy who stands out for me. It's like, man, these shows have been so great without John Pollock. And I replied to him and I said, it's refreshing, isn't it? He said, it really has been.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
It was nice. It was nice. As I roam the streets of St. Petersburg alone.
That's
feeling terrible. Completely detached from life.
You asshole.
And I got that tweet where I just, a tear came out of my eye and froze before it hit the cold concrete of St. Petersburg, Russia. But I picked myself up. And I tried to recover.
You so. Assholes! You gotta be grateful that this guy is even.
No, all I ask for is
the time of day.
This is not thy Pollock's kingdom come. This is I want the truth from people. So as we get on out of here, Survivor Series 93 next week. Coming up later this week, a full slate of shows. The MMA Report. I'm going to be joined by Sean Wheelock, play-by-play commentator for Bellator. They've got their big show coming up Saturday that is now free on Spike TV. Yeah. Will you be watching Michael Chandler, Eddie Alvarez?
I will, now that it's free on TV.
Oh, you were not going to watch it on pay-per-view.
I probably would have tried to catch it somehow, but this makes it much more easy.
What do you mean, catch it somehow? It's not going to be like a ball in the air coming at you.
Oh, I mean, I probably would have maybe ventured off to the office to watch it. I knew a bunch of people would watch it there, but now I'll just watch it at home.
I bought Hell in a Cell on Sunday night when I got home.
Cool.
First time I have watched a WWE show on my own at home without, you know, taking notes or going to the Law after since I started with the show back in September of 2003, over a decade.
What was that like?
It was very weird to just sit down and watch a WWE pay-per-view and not have to do a report for the site or take notes or be hurrying out of my condo to make the air in 10 minutes after the main event. It's very relaxing.
Oh.
So.
Well, maybe you should try it more often. Just, like, don't take notes and just go off of memory.
I guess I could do that.
Maybe. I don't know.
We'll find out.
I don't know. I'm actually trying to look for a song right now. That's why I'm
coming. Oh, okay. Well, as you look for that song, so the MMA Report will feature Sean Wheelock and Loretta Hunt, who attended TNA Bound for Glory in San Diego a couple of weeks
ago.
Wait
a second. Is this the same Loretta Hunt of MMA journalism?
Yeah, Loretta Hunt of SI.com is going to be joining me. We're going to chat mainly MMA, but we're definitely going to talk a bit about Bound for Glory. See what she had to say about AJ Styles, Bully Ray.
Does she actually watch pro wrestling?
No, she really doesn't. She was doing a story on Dixie Carter, and that's what took her. Actually, we'll tell the story on the air. I planted this seed in her head about going to San Diego for Bound for Glory because she didn't know where it was. And she was like, that's not a bad idea. And she ended up going.
Okay, so you created this story. And what was the story that she was going to do?
She did a story on Dixie Carter running this company.
Interesting.
So we'll see if Loretta maybe has some dirt on what's happening in TNA right now.
Yeah, I wonder.
Yeah, look at that. Loretta Hunt with some wrestling scoops, potentially. And then Friday, the reunion of John Pollock, Wei Ting, and Nate Milton for a review and Impact. Impact's becoming a lot of fun.
Yeah, I hope we can talk to Nate. I mean, it is Halloween, so we will get Impact up probably Friday.
Yeah, it'll be up Friday. Me and Way are going out for Halloween Thursday night. We're dressing up as Triple H and Stephanie.
Yeah.
And we're going to go to church.
We're going to go to church. We'll be driving through the
Braden's going as China. It's going to be very awkward
because
I'm going to be talking to Way, and then when Braden comes, I'm going to ignore you just so he doesn't realize anything for a year and a half.
Yeah.
All right.
And Jason will be test.
Oh, well, that's unfortunate.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Because then someone would have to be Vince to completely overstep.
Yeah, Gordon will be
Gordon, of course. The
A lot of people thought Gordon was going to be our guest host for Review of Raw instead of Tom Lawler.
Gordon, Tom Lawler, they're often mistaken.
My dad, yeah.
Oh, your dad would have been the ultimate guest
That's not
host.
Happening, everybody.
No, that's too bad.
Shall we go out with one of these songs?
Whatever you want.
Well, I randomly typed Thy Kingdom Come in my phone, and here's what came up.
Jay-Z.
Nope. Virgin Steel. Thy Kingdom Come.
Well, Virgin Steel. I don't know what that is, but let's take a listen.
Enjoy the sound of Virgin Steel.
Of all time, you know, the best ever. Hunter's one of those guys.
I know that he wants to be Vince McMahon. Nobody wants to be Vince McMahon. No, just that he's one of the most wonderful things that ever happened to me and to the business. He's a good man.